This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Blogging Theology. Today, I'm delighted to talk to Dr. Rania Awad, MD. You are most welcome. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Wonderful to be here with you. Thank you so much for this invitation.
Absolutely, my pleasure. Thank you. And just to introduce you to the viewers a bit more, Dr. Awad is a clinical professor of psychiatry at the Stanford University School of Medicine, where she is the director of the Stanford Muslim Mental Health and Islamic Psychology Lab, as well as Stanford University's affiliate chaplain and affiliate professor of Islamic Studies. In the community, she serves as president and co-founder of the Mariston.org, a holistic mental health nonprofit serving Muslim communities, and the director of the Rahma Foundation, a nonprofit organization dedicated to educating Muslim women and girls. In addition, she is a faculty of Islamic psychology at the Cambridge Muslim College here in England and the Islamic Seminary of America. She's also a senior fellow for Yakin Institute and the Institute of Social Policy and Understanding. Prior to studying medicine, she pursued classical Islamic studies in Damascus in Syria and holds certifications, that's ijaza, in the Quran, Islamic law, and other branches of the Islamic sciences. And you can follow her on a Twitter handle, which I will put in the link in the description below, as well as to the other organizations I mentioned just now. Now, today, Dr. Awad has kindly agreed to discuss an extremely important and often overlooked subject, actually, the internalized Islamophobia that is affecting Muslim, American Muslim communities from within. It's a really important subject. So if I may, Dr. Awad, over to you.
Thank you so very much for this opportunity to discuss, yes, a very difficult conversation, but definitely one that's very important. Mm. I think the best thing really to do to kind of frame the discussion is probably to share a story. And the story is, it's one that takes place actually in my own clinic at Stanford University. And for me, I think it was a defining moment to understand what is this term Islamophobia, particularly internalized Islamophobia? What does that mean exactly? And so the story is that in one of my clinics one day, I had two patients, one after another, both Muslim women, one who wore a full niqab and face covering, her hijab and niqab, so fully covered in black, and the other Muslim woman does not cover. One had just completed her session with me and we were walking out into the hallway for her to leave. And in the hallway is the waiting room where I'm calling back the next patient to my office. And I could see that my second patient was visibly shaken, just somebody who was really kind of very anxious and anxious at baseline, but today was more than usual. And so I, you know, didn't say anything out of privacy in the hallway, but as we entered into my office, sat down, checked in with her and said, "What's happening? You doing okay? Like, what's going on?" And she just sort of really trembling, kind of like a leaf trembling, and said, "Why was that other lady here? What is she doing in a place like Stanford University? What is someone like her dressed like that think they're doing here?" And, you know, I took a moment, helped her kind of breathe through this a little bit, but eventually said to her, "You know, I can't share any details out of confidentiality for what's, you know, why this other patient is there, but I'm very, you know, curious about your own response to what's happening here." And she said, "Well, I think people that look like that give Muslims a bad rep. And in a place like Stanford, that really, that kind of dress doesn't belong."
Wow.
So we talked through this. And eventually, as we were talking through and kind of processing everything, and what I can say, share with you and I couldn't share with her, in, you know, is just that the other patient really had a lot of the same family complaints and interpersonal issues that were happening as the second patient, but you know, she's done the wiser related to that, and it had nothing to do with her niqab or the way she covered. And so as we kind of processed a little bit more my second patient's reactions, at the end of it all, she sort of sat back in the chair and just sort of sighed and let a sigh of relief out and sort of said, "Man, the media has done a number on me too."
Wow. Right?
kind of connecting and realizing that she had been holding all this internalized fear, irrational fear, which is what how we define Islamophobia, of Islam and Muslims or the symbols that represent them. Mm. And that to me was very telling. It was kind of this defining moment for me of realizing, wow, even for us as Muslims, we have taken in a lot of what the media has said about Muslims, what others have been saying negatively or incorrectly, a lot of the misinformation that's out there, and carry that along with us and don't realize sometimes that it's these unconscious or what we would call in our field kind of an implicit bias that we carry around to our own.
Yeah. I think what if I may just say a really interesting point you make there about the term Islamophobia, because often conservative commentators in the West say, well, Islamophobia, this word, they don't like it because it just means you can't criticize Islam. You can't disagree with Islam, they say. But you've defined it clinically, I think, as an irrational fear of Muslims, perhaps, or Islam. So it's not based on an objection that might be rationalized. It's irrational. It's not based on information and knowledge. And I think that's a really important definition you've given there.
Definitely. And that the term phobia in psychiatry is exactly the same type of understanding, that it's an irrational fear of something that when you break it down and analyze it, doesn't quite add up. No. And neither does the amount of affect or reaction that comes with it as well.
And I just want to really ask, if I may, we've all heard about, you know, other phobias and other irrational prejudices that people have against groups of people. Obviously, we all know what that might be. But and that's recognized in psychology and in the academy as, you know, a problem that we need to address and understand and analyze and find ways through this. Can we now say that that is true for Islamophobia, as you've defined it? Is this a recognized problem in psychology, for example?
Not in the clinical textbooks. However, the entire field of Islamophobia is a massive field in which there's been a lot of writing, studying, and research on it. In many ways, some of the experts on Islamophobia may also disagree with the exact terminology of it. There may have been a better way to actually conceptualize this entire this concept. However, as Dr. Hatem Bazian, who is one of the main writers, I would say, in the current era on Islamophobia, often says, the train has left the station on this particular term. It's really what has been coined and used for such a long time now. And so we'll continue to use it, understanding that there probably could be other better ways to exactly capture the meanings of what's happening here.
But your definition and your experience there, would that be recognized by your professional colleagues as an example of irrational fear and treated as such?
Or sure, the concept of phobia, absolutely. Anything that is anything, really, there could be, and it's very individualized from person to person, so it may not be in the DSM, in our manual of diagnosis, but really any fear that a person may have that is irrational and also elicits a response that is not, that is above and beyond what would be typical, it is categorized as a phobia.
Interesting. Now, you mentioned, I mentioned in your introduction to your work that you've discussed internalized Islamophobia that is affecting Muslim communities in America particularly. And I don't think it's just America, by the way. It's in a number of other places in Europe as well, of course, and maybe other places as well. But it's in terms of the social dynamics here. How does that work? Are we talking about people who are individually consuming Islamophobic, prejudicial kind of concepts from the media or from TikTok or Twitter or YouTube? Or is there a more kind of social dynamic to this, that whole communities are affected in some way?
So that's, yes, definitely. I think that's something to see. So I'll clarify first that a lot of the research that I do in my lab is focused on American Muslims. That is where, right. where I reside and where a lot of my research is. But I absolutely agree with you that it's really similar in other Western nations and really wherever you find the Muslim diaspora. I mean, you really find this all throughout the world. And we focus a lot on the English speaking populations in our research. But yes, I would say that it's beyond just the individual. There are different layers of Islamophobia. The individual being, if you think of it as almost like concentric circles, one circle within another, nested within one another, you start at the individual level, and there are direct effects. And some of this starts right at home. And that's why we always say we need to point inwards before we point outwards. Kind of similar to the story that I mentioned, there are things that happen even in how we discuss what is acceptable and what isn't in terms of, for example, outward Islamic appearance of women or men, children. And so you have an individualized level. Beyond that, you go into more of a community, and that starts at the local level. What was that community like? Was there any support or wasn't there? Mm. Beyond that, you kind of go out into a national level. So for us, we kind of look at the entire United States and what is happening, kind of what is the rhetoric that is being said about Muslims. And then you kind of enter out into the global domain. All of these stacked one upon another absolutely affect how Islamophobia is driven.
And is it the case that men and women experience this differently as well? Obviously, the hijab or the niqab is a very visible social sign, unavoidable. But for men, are men affected by this kind of internalized Islamophobia in the United States?
Certainly men and children, but women take the cake here. They absolutely do. All of the research has shown that Muslim women who are visibly identifiable as Muslims by their hijab or other dresswear, that they definitely are the symbol of Islam. Mm-hmm. And so therefore, so much of the hate crimes and other violence, even and even, you know, smaller biases that come towards them tend to come to Muslim women the most. But certainly men experience this too, and the more visible as Muslims they are, whether that be by clothing or whether that be by facial hair or
wearing a beard, would that be I don't mean just a stubble, I mean a big beard.
A big beard, sure. Yeah. Sure. Although one might say that, you know, in recent years, the beard has also become kind of a fashion statement for some. Yeah. So and here's where, you know, names matter, what a person's name is could make a big difference. Yeah. And then children, the stats related to Islamophobia in children are heartbreaking. And as I see this as a parent, knowing that as I send my children out into the world who are visibly identifiable as Muslims and have names as such, knowing that there's a 50-50 chance, it's nearly 49-50% of all Muslim children in the U.S. will experience some level of identity-based Islamophobia directed towards them. But because of their Muslim identity, either their names, what they wear, even what they eat at school in their lunch boxes, right?
So 49-50%, that's half of us. It's an incredible statistic.
It is. It's an incredible statistic and heartbreaking. And this is where so many Muslim families, like the first patient I was referring to, you know, make a decision about, do we want to be visibly identifiable and recognizable into the world? Or do we kind of make this more private?
So the pressure must be enormous on Muslim women not to wear hijab or perhaps for men and women not to have Islamic names publicly, Islamic names. So, you know, call themselves Mo rather than Muhammad. I'm not so sure what they would say. But, you know, the emphasis is very much on invisibility sometimes rather than being yourself and having an identity. You know, America prides itself in being a free country where freedom of religion is practiced allegedly, and valued allegedly as a political and social value. So there seems to be a disconnect between the rhetoric and the reality, certainly when it comes to Muslims then.
Yeah. Absolutely. And I think that's the story that I was sharing earlier was kind of like encapsulated in real time. You could see kind of the one who decided to take a stance. And what was important too, and I didn't share this earlier, is, you know, this is not a woman who comes from a family of hijab wearing or niqab wearing women. She made a very personal decision that meant a lot to her and kind of took that stand, not just in hijab, but full niqab. And then you almost see the example on the other side of a Muslim woman who's also proud to be a Muslim, but very private about her Islam.
Right. So, I mean, how do you mentioned the extraordinary statistic, half the children are affected by this. How do you clinically or as a carer actually come alongside these people and their families? How do you help them? Because surely there's nothing that can be done in that the forces are, there's an asymmetry of power and influence. So how do you assist them in somehow dealing with this reality?
Absolutely. For me, the parents are important 100%. I'm actually quite interested in the youth. A lot of the work I do in the community is actually on a youth level. Locally, we run multiple girls halakas or kind of youth groups and youth camps and different things that we do for kind of empowerment. And so knowledge is empowerment, and being able to get to a point where you feel proud of who you are and your identity, realizing that you're going to be out there and going to be questioned, and you'll get the funny looks and may even have, unfortunately, negative attention come your way as well. But also realizing that the kind of the core identity that I often speak to the girls that I mentor, and those who mentor the girls, we have a mentorship program, is Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is with you. Like, that God is with you. And if this is a requirement of your faith, because God has put it there, then he's never going to put something or enforce something that actually isn't the best for you. And so it's almost like a cognitive shift that needs to happen, you know, kind of a reframing this whole discussion of what could be negative, and realizing there are risks really to everything out there. But that sense of like pride in oneself and knowing that God is overseeing everything and protecting you, as you are careful in protecting yourself, of course, but that God is there with you, is powerful. And I find that so many young girls kind of, again, that's who I mentor, often really take on that message and feel that sense of pride, and are able to go into their schools or into their programs with their hijabs and feel very confident in that.
Well, this touches on a fascinating subject, because when I think of psychology or psychiatry, normally I think of like Sigmund Freud, or, you know, I think of these quite atheist or materialist kind of outlooks or assumptions, particularly, you know, Sigmund Freud, who was very, you know, a passionate atheist in many ways. It motivated him. Apparently, but your understanding of psychology and psychiatry, I guess, seems to be much more, for want of a better word, holistic. It includes the spiritual, from what you're saying. So you're talking about changing the paradigm, so that this is a much more holistic approach to human well-being than the narrowly reductionist or materialist approach. So that's very interesting, I think.
Absolutely. I can't tell you how much the rendition on psychology being this Freudian psychology is so problematic. And for me, it's been really the catalyst to look into what else is there. So I welcome you and everybody else listening, actually, to the newest kind of emerging field within the field of psychology today, which is understood to be religion and spirituality. And so there is quite an emphasis and a push, actually, to have religion and spirituality be part and parcel of the field of psychology. When I was training, you know, I did my training at Stanford, and when I was there early on and I was trying to speak about these things in the early days of my training, I had people say, there is no space for this in this department. This doesn't belong in the field of psychiatry. We don't know what you're talking about. Yeah. However, it's not just myself. There's actually researchers and clinicians across the faith spectrum, you know, all different faith backgrounds, who have been writing and pushing this domain. And I'll share with you something, you know, just to start to see the change happening in the field of psychology. This last couple months ago, the annual conference on the American Psychological Association, or the APA, the largest body that kind of governs and puts on the conferences, which of thousands and thousands of people in the field of psychology, hosted a conference in which they had on their main stage, this is the first time in their 130-year history, on their main stage, a topic on religion and mental health. This was
the first time, you said.
First time in 130 years.
I've been to America. I tell you, people haven't been there. I mean, it's officially a secular state, I understand. Correct me if I'm wrong. But boy, is your country religious.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I mean, it really is. I mean, okay, there are pockets of secularity, maybe bits of New York, a bit secular. You go out there, you know, people are very proud of being Christian or Muslim or whatever, very religious. Whereas Britain, ironically, is technically a Christian country, that our king is head of the church. Yet people don't like, it's embarrassing to talk about religion in public, you know, but America's very different. So I say that because I'm surprised at what you have just said in the 100 or so years of existence of this prestigious premier psychological study. There's a first time in the United States that religion has been on the agenda. And I find that astonishing.
Absolutely. And it's in the main stage too. I mean, it's probably likely had talks in different years, but this is the first time where it's like the organization itself is putting it onto the main stage, realizing and recognizing there is a gap here that they have completely ignored. If we go back to the history of psychology just very briefly and say, if we break down the term psychology, in the Latin understanding of the root of the word psychology, the psyche means breath, spirit, right? And of course, this is the study of the breath or spirit. And it's interesting in that this is how psychology actually began, even in Europe, but eventually changed over time and moved into much more of an empirical, rational science in which nothing else other than that which you can reproduce in a lab and test and see now under an fMRI machine, right? If you can't touch it and prove it, it doesn't exist. So the discussion on the soul just flew out right out the window. And many people criticize the field of psychology today, and quite literally it makes sense in that it, quote, lost its soul.
Yes, both literally and metaphorically, it sounds. Yes. Yeah. Gosh.
And this is an effort to kind of bring it back, an effort to really come back to, you know, full circle to how the field began and the importance of what happens when you leave out, or, you know, another saying in the field is when people come into therapy in a very secularized understanding of the field and a clinical practice of it, they have to, quote, check God at the door. Mm. Right. And that's very hard for a person who comes from a faith background, right? In which God is, they come from a God-centered worldview. And that's how they understand their life and how they, even how they cope with everything coming through. It's quite hard.
I completely sympathize and agree. But there is a problem, is there not? Because if psychology, I'm kind of pushing back a little bit for the sake of argument in a way. If psychology is supposed to be scientific, okay, if it is a science, whatever that means. And, you know, science, we have other scientists, we have physics, we have chemistry, we have biology, and so on. These also, in terms of their methodology, as you put it, check God at the door. So a physicist wouldn't normally speak of the marvel. I mean, he or she could do, but my experience, they don't tend to publicly say, well, the universe is a marvel of God's design. And we can investigate the mechanisms of that design, the laws of physics, and so on. They wouldn't use that language. They'd check it at the door. So couldn't a psychologist say, in trying to be scientific as well, that we would check that language at the door, whilst personally he or she may be a believer? You see what I mean? It's a question of how it's done rather than a metaphysical declining of religion. It's just our way of doing science excludes that language. Does that make sense, what I'm saying?
It does. But that exclusionary language has effects. All language has effect, right? And the effect eventually becomes completely excising it out of the field altogether, even looking down upon it, even not just looking down upon, but literally demeaning it. And I think that's the feel. I mean, certainly when I was going through training, similar to what you mentioned, being in Britain, I mean, you can't even bring up religion. You are literally considered the laughstock, right, of the group, and not rigorous or scientific enough, nor your research. But the reality is, back to research and scientific study, when you look at some of these studies that have now, you know, back when I was training, we were in the hundreds. Now they're in the thousands of studies that show the direct connection between one's spirituality or religion and their physical and mental well-being. So we have proofs related to now research study after research study after research study in which there is everything that you would want in a scientific study, right? You
have empirical evidence now.
Empirical as it gets, right?
Prayer, meditation. It needn't be Islamic, of course. It could be Hindu, whatever. But no, this is not a metaphysical, it's not theology. But nevertheless, the practice of spirituality in some form is intrinsic to the well-being, the physical, mental, spiritual well-being of human beings. And this is empirically established now, as you say, over and over and over again.
Over and over. You have direct connections in, you know, cardiac, for example. You might think, well, that's very biological, scientific, right? Heart conditions. And the connection between that and between figuring out whether a person is depressed or not, the connection between the two, that one affects the other.
Wow.
Right. And as you help the depression, you also help the cardiac condition as well. I mean, these are well established at this point. It's so plentiful that it's hard any longer to push back on it.
Right. I mean, I can't help but think of what the Quran says about the fitra, the sense of the innate disposition that human beings have in our human nature to worship God and to connect. So that this would be a description of that scientifically, of what the Quran is already teaching us about the nature of what it is to be human. We have this, you know, we're God's creatures. And so we would obviously flourish as human beings if we behaved in the way that we're created to be, to worship God, for example.
Correct, absolutely. And that I would say was definitely an impetus for the early Muslims, who of course in that Islamic heritage did amazing work related to science, medicine, right? Amazing advances, and focused quite a bit on psychology, focused quite a bit on the field today we call psychology, then they called ilmun nafs, or the science of the self. Yeah. And when you look at their work and you figure out what inspired them, verses in the Quran or in the Hadith directly correspond to that impetus, that catalyst in which they said, you know, the Quran says, look within yourselves. The signs of God are within yourself, and look out into the world around you, because those are the signs of God too. And realize that if God is telling us to take care of ourselves, and the baseline, literally the baseline of all Islamic duty starts with one being sane, that you have mental capacity. And so if somebody in front of you does not have mental capacity, then there is this impetus to actually try to help them reach that point so that they can fulfill their personal obligatory duties and the duties to those around them. This becomes a core principle. This principle is a core impetus really for what inspired the early Muslims to do all the work they did.
There's something that's very, very interesting, this subject, I must say. And of course, you are now a clinical professor of psychiatry at Stanford University. So clearly, the university now accepts the validity, the raison d'etre, everything you're saying has been totally on ball, and they want to support it and endow you with a chair. So that's fantastic news. But I'm still not 100% clear. Many people perhaps are not 100% clear. I mean, you're also on the Faculty of Islamic Psychology at the Cambridge Muslim College, which I mentioned, which is in the UK. What is Islamic psychology? I mean, you described the benefits of a kind of integrating a holistic understanding, spirituality, perhaps meditation, perhaps yoga, maybe for other people and so on. But what is distinctly Islamic psychology? Do you see what I mean? How is that conceptualized?
Yes, and what happens when you put the word Islamic before any discipline? What does that mean exactly? Yes. Absolutely. And so if I could take just a step back and say that there are two connected, related fields, but they overlap, but they're different than one another. And so it helps me explain what Islamic psychology is. And that's the other field that's connected, which is the Muslim mental health field. Mm-hmm. And when you put the word Muslim in front of something, in this case, mental health, we're talking about populations, Muslim populations. However it is that they practice or don't, the Islamic religion here is not quite as prevalent. It's really talking about different populations that are Muslim and their mental health. As soon as we go into Islamic psychology, now we're talking about the religion itself. We're talking about its foundational principles, the thing that basically the scaffolding comes from the faith itself, and then you build a psychology upon it. So we often refer to this as a bottoms-up approach, where you have the scaffolding of the religion at the bottom, then you build upon it a psychology. That understanding is actually quite different than Muslim mental health, even when they overlap with one another.
Okay, so what is Islamic psychology then? So it's based on the religion itself, but how does it connect with your colleagues who are in psychology? What do you tell them? I practice Islamic psychology, and they say, well, I'm just a psychologist. I mean, if you know what I mean, how do you have that conversation with someone who, you know, claims the generic psychology, if you like, as if that's kind of the more essential element, and you have a variant of that? I'm not saying that's how it is, but how would you explain that to yourself?
It is sometimes, but I would like to. You just clarify as well that there's no such thing as a generic psychology. The psychology we talk about today is a Western psychology. It's a Eurocentric psychology. Right. It's a psychology that when we talk about modern psychology, its roots are very Eurocentric. Right. And everything comes, this is where people sometimes don't realize this until we kind of take a step back. I do this with my Stanford students in their class. I teach a class to our psychiatry trainees called Religion and Culture in Psychiatry. And often at the very beginning of every one of these classes, in every cohort I've taught now, this is our 12th cohort of this class, you know, somebody raises their hand and says, you know, why are we doing this? And isn't there just kind of your question, the same as your question? Is it just psychology? Well, why are we talking about this? And so I say to them, or somebody might say to me, I don't even think I don't have a religion, and I'm not even sure I have a culture. And I say to them, yes, but if I were to pick you up right now and drop you in the Gambia, do you now have a culture? Like, you sometimes have to reframe and help people understand that everything has a bias to it. Everything is colored by an experience. So for us, when we talk about what is Islamic psychology, it is such. And I'm going to use the Ghazalian model of Imam Ghazali's model of understanding the human psyche.
Imam Ghazali died in 1111 of the Common Era, a very, very famous Islamic philosopher or theologian and many, many things. But
Yes. And one of the many people who contributed to the field of Islamic psychology. And his model of the human psyche is really what a lot of this is based on. It's the understanding that at the very core is the connection with a human being with their Lord. And that connection is a spiritual connection. And so he connects it from the heart, the qalb, but it's the metaphysical heart, not the heart that beats in your chest.
And Dr. Awad, can I pause you there? Sorry, this word, the heart, because I know particularly myself, before I was a Muslim, and I came across this language of the heart. Of course, I only knew about the physical pump in my rib cage, so to speak. So when you start talking about the heart thinking, feeling, connecting, I think it doesn't make any sense. How can a heart, a biological mechanism, possibly do that? But Islamically, and this is the point, I think, of mentioning this, is the Islamic conception of the heart is much richer and more profound than the pump that we in the materialist West have now reduced this language to. And this is your point about how culturally specific that psychology has become. Sorry to pause there, but could you just, what do you mean by the word heart?
Yes, it's very similar to what you just said. I appreciate that very much. The difference between the physical and the metaphysical. So here, so often in the West, when we think about a thinking person or thinking in general, we think cognition, we go straight to the brain. And the field of psychology today, modern psychology, that's exactly, I mean, look at where I'm housed. I'm housed in, you know, any department of psychiatry, and even psychology today is usually housed in the School of Medicine, usually in the sciences. And so there you find a very kind of rational, empirical kind of field, and a lot less related to the emotional and or kind of the spiritual connection we were talking about earlier. So not in the humanities and not anywhere near the anything related to divinity. So here, the metaphysical heart then is one that's able to, as you mentioned, ration. It's able to think. It's able to make decisions. Mm-hmm. And it needs to be cleansed as well. There are diseases of the heart and there's a purification of the heart, which Imam Ghazali spends a lot of time in his books outlining and detailing what that is. And as Muslims, we are as concerned about the health of our heart, the physical, but also very much the metaphysical heart, in purifying that heart in order to then be able to do better and be well, have a sense of wellness, which is why the core Imam Ghazali's model, he puts the heart right at the center. More important than the brain or cognition in this.
So where is this heart? I mean, maybe I'm using inappropriate language, so correct me if I'm wrong, but where is this heart located? Or is it not in a spatial dimension?
It's not in a spatial dimension.
Right. This is the thing, you see, because the cardio, the physical heart, is located in a spatial dimension, obviously. So this is a spiritual. So it's not a metaphor, this is it. It's an ontological reality. It's not just a metaphor. So this is real, or even perhaps more real, I don't know, than the physical heart, but it doesn't have a spatial temporal locality that we can point to and say, oh, there it is. Is that correct?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And if you think about it as the core, then you have different things that connect to it. And so one we've already mentioned, the cognition, right? And so that the Arabic term is aql, right? To be able to understand. And many people might kind of understand that as the brain, or at this point in time, the mind is probably the better way to translate that. Also connected to it is the ruh being the soul. And this is where I was saying the study of the soul has been largely lost, but part of the Islamic tradition, it's part and parcel. It's directly connected to this subject. Right. Another connection is the nafs, or the self. And this is where, in terms of both of these, and sometimes people conflate the two of these, ruh and nafs, but they're actually different entities. Mm. And Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks about them in the Quran and outlines them. He talks about different levels of nafs, for example, the tranquil nafs, the one that is pulling, right, to evil, and then you have to kind of continue to fight against it, right, and kind of do your jihad or nafs, or struggle against the nafs to do better. And so you have, as I was mentioning, the ruh connected, the nafs connected, the aqid, or the cognition connected to this qalb. And also in some of the models, you also see ihsas, or emotions, connected as well.
You use a very strong word. You said, talk about the diseases of the heart. Now, when I think of heart disease, I'm immediately thinking of blocked arteries, you know, eating the wrong kind of food, not getting exercise, whatever. But you didn't mean that. You meant, I don't think, the diseases of the heart that you're speaking of are what? Spiritual diseases? Yeah. Diseases, right. And why are they called diseases? And what is their cure? You're not taking tablets. We're not having physical exercise, are we? There's a whole different regime operating here. So could you expand a bit about, you know, exactly what you mean by the word disease and the cure, inverted commas, that is offered in the Islamic spiritual / psychological approach to this?
Absolutely. Absolutely. The best way to explain this, if I may, is to also take a step back here too and explain. There's a hadith or saying of the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, that in which he's asked to explain about this religion. And he explains it in three levels, and explains that the first level of it is Islam. So kind of the five pillars that many people are familiar with of Islam. And the next layer up is Iman, the belief system, the aqidah, or the creed that Muslims believe. And the third layer up, which is what I'm going to focus on here, is Ihsan. And Ihsan being kind of that level of excellence, right? Mm-hmm. And that connectedness. So when a person, you could be a Muslim at any of these levels, but the ideal is to kind of get to the very top, right? To kind of work your way through the three levels. And so if you've done your five pillars, you're praying, you're fasting, you're giving your charity, and you have your Iman, your core belief system, what's left then to do is really work on purifying and bettering oneself, that level of excellence or ihsan. So much of the science of the diseases of the heart is really focusing on not so much the clinical diseases that you were mentioning, kind of like heart disease, you know, a blocked artery, or even a psychiatric disease, depression, anxiety, but actually looking more here at things like greed, gluttony, vanity, love of the limelight, you know, all of these different types of spiritual diseases, which in Islam and a lot of the Muslim spiritual scholars of the inner sciences say that those diseases are just as deadly as the physical ones and need their treatments and cures just as physical illnesses. And if we ignore it, then you're out of balance. You may be very healthy because you run a mile every day and eat very, very healthy food and sleep well, right? And maybe you also kind of do well in terms of morality. You're a good moral person and treat others well. But if you don't have the spiritual connectedness where you're able to also make sure you're somebody who doesn't lie and cheat and steal and cause others harm, then you're out of balance. It's not holistic. You are not a holistic person in your wellness. So there's a huge gap here missing. You're not in the DSM.
No, carry on, sorry.
You won't see this. You won't see these illnesses, these diseases in the DSM, our Diagnostic Manual of Psychiatry.
Right.
But I'm very hopeful that it's the Muslims that will come together with actually putting a more complete manual of what are all the different illnesses that need to be treated, both physical and spiritual.
Yes, I'm fascinated because I come from a Christian background. A lot of what you said would resonate from that context. So the language of the heart, the Bible talks about the heart. The psalmist, for example, in the book of Psalms, talks about the human heart. And the prophets sometimes talk about how corrupt the human heart is. And they're not talking about the physical organ in our rib cage. They're using the same, I think, the same concept. And I think also, so that's found in the Jewish Bible and therefore in the Christian tradition, it's in the Islamic tradition, and I think it's in other traditions as well, in the Far Eastern traditions as well. So this seems to be a quite a common, almost universal language in traditional religions that is used, that science, in inverted commas, in this Western construct, as you would describe it, has kind of bleached out in the name of science, I suppose, this kind of very rationalist, empiricist, materialist kind of way of looking at things. So your approach is both very new and very old, isn't it? It's not, yeah. It's a technology that's been around for millennia, probably around the world for millennia, but it seems new and some kind of fresh and so on, because it's been lost perhaps in the Western context anyway.
And I would say a term that you had brought up earlier, which is the concept of fitra. Fitra, yes. Is that innate, yes. Kind of connection where we know, you can't necessarily always put your finger on it, but you know inside of yourself, mm-hmm. and that's that deep connection with God. And so this is a human aspect. It's not limited to Muslims. It's really all humans can recognize fitra when they see it, when they, yes. hear about it. And so when someone hears about this and understands even the concept of holistic well-being, balancing mind, body, and soul, regardless of their background, usually they're able to say, yes, that's what I want. I want that. I want that balance, yes. right there.
Yeah, mizan, as it's called in the Arabic tradition. But a slightly controversial question here. If you don't want to answer it, that's fine. I'm very interested in atheists and atheism. Okay, I mean both the theoretical and the individual. I know atheists. Some of them are even sort of vaguely friends. Not many of them, but and I have a suspicion. And I was wondering if you have any clinical view or professional view on this. And again, if you don't have a view, that's fine. But My intuition is that a lot of atheists are atheists because they're very angry with God. So they might have had some bad experience, some relationship or work or whatever, some existential crisis, an acute event in their lives. And for me, the opposite of love is not hate, but indifference. When you say, I'm not going to hate you, I'm going to say in my anger, you don't even exist. You know, it's wiping them out completely. It's the ultimate kind of dissing of someone, if you like. My suspicion is, based on precisely little evidence, really, just anecdotal evidence, is that a lot of atheists, self-called, are actually angry at God at some level. Because you mentioned the fitra, we talked about the fitra. This is our natural disposition for our species. So atheism doesn't really fit, does it, in that? So I'm looking for some kind of explanation on the heart level, your heart, so to speak, the heart you've been speaking about, that makes sense of atheists. Because often they'll say to me, well, I'm an atheist because I haven't seen any evidence for God. And I'm thinking, well, what evidence do you want? It's all around you, you know, it's the universe. But they don't seem very happy with that. And I'm thinking, well, there's something going on there that seems more than the presenting rationale of their atheism. Do you see what I mean? Do you have a view on that? You might want.
I do. And I think there's definitely something to be said about anger. We certainly see that quite a bit in therapy and in our sessions that we work on with individuals. Sometimes I also wonder how much of it is veiled or called by another name. For example, in many of the patients that I've worked with, and I will say this, I'll give this caveat and say, as somebody from a faith background, working with somebody who's not from a faith background in therapy, it could be quite stifling sometimes, because sometimes they're seeing the world in such a bleak way. And maybe what they're describing is a very traumatic, terrible thing that's happened. And with a believer, they understand that there is a judgment day and there is a better day coming after this, mm-hmm. right? The hereafter, in which there is goodness to come after this difficult life. This is a world of tribulations, dotted bala, as we call it here on earth. Mm-hmm. And so when you don't have that point of view, yes, you can get a lot of anger, resentment. Also, I would say maybe also veiled by another name. So often what we find people say is they'll say, well, I'm going to channel, you know, all this energy out into the universe, and the universe will respond. You know, I'll manifest, I'll say what I want, and it manifests. And, you know, it's honestly, a rose by any other name is still a rose, right? Like, what are they doing other than dua? Like, that is essentially what they're manifesting into the world. Yet they are not able to use the language of religion because they have walked away from that. And so sometimes it's anger, but sometimes it's also availing of the terminology or using different terminology to say the same things that honestly a person of faith.
That's very interesting. You're looking beneath the surface of the term that's used. Actually, underneath, they're acting a little bit like believers, even though they'll deny it at the surface level.
Certainly. Yes.
Gosh, that's very interesting insight. Okay.
And then there's the third thing I would say is a word, a term that you mentioned as well, which is dissonance, a cognitive dissonance, where a person is essentially of two minds, where if you were to kind of, and we do this, we're able to do this in therapy sometimes, is actually go deeper into the discussion and really go back into people's core beliefs, their core belief systems. And we do this a lot in CBT or cognitive behavioral therapy, where you really talk about negative core beliefs that people walk around with. Things like, you know, the world is unsafe. Mm-hmm. Nobody's kind, right? Things like this, where people walk around. So they have a lot of critical thoughts to the world around them and people.
Yes.
In doing that, we often tell people you're essentially of two minds because you go out every day. Yes, sure, you lock your car in your front door, but you also interact with people at the grocery store or do things every day, and those people are safe. So it's not always unsafe. So there's two minds that are happening sometimes, and sometimes you have to be able to help people connect the dots and then do behavioral change.
Mm. And it's also for some people also that they might be more favorably disposed towards belief or faith during the summer when they're feeling happy and more optimistic, and when they've eaten a good meal, or, you know, things are going well with their family, rather than, you know, in the bleak midwinter when things are not going so good and they're financially challenged. And so, you know, there might also be that kind of, you know, life just makes us more amenable to one than the other, you know, rather than a committed position that one holds, you sort of mean. So it could be quite fluid, I suppose.
I think so. In fact, I would say the majority of people that I meet sort of are agnostic. They sort of say, I just don't know. They're not willing to take that hard stance of there is no God, right? And I'm going to discount it. And there's some more sort of in the middle, because again, when you scratch the surface and go deep enough, they realize that they're not getting up out of bed every morning and able to take that first breath without some assistance that's not of their own, right? Yeah.
Oh, that's a lovely way of putting it. I like that. It's very nice. Okay. Finally, then, if I may, for interested viewers, it does include myself. What resources would you recommend then for people to access? Could be YouTube, could be books, or whatever. If people want to explore Islamic psychology better or in greater depth to help them personally, but also academically to understand the discipline.
Sure. Yes. There's a couple of resources. One is if they're willing to read something a little more dense, if you will, for those who want, you know, more in-depth in understanding, we've actually written a book on this topic, and it's actually called Islamic Psychology, and it's Introducing Islamic Principles into Clinical Mental Health Care. And so this is published by Routledge, and they're able to take a look and read more in-depth, particularly those first introductory chapters that really outline and explain what is Islamic psychology and what are the models that we're using to define it. And certainly for clinicians that might be interested in working on this and integrating this in their own clinical practice. Mm-hmm. For those who are willing to read academic papers, but not a whole book, I would direct them towards my lab's website, the Stanford University's Muslim Mental Health and Islamic Psychology Lab. On our publications page, we have all of our publications. Actually, you can click them and immediately read all of the articles that we have published.
These are available. They're not behind a paywall or anything like that.
They're not behind a paywall. They're right on the website. Right. Yes.
Exactly. And for a more popular or a more generally accessible resource, would you
get? Yes. And for those who are not deep readers, I would say another resource to really learn about the connection between Islam and psychology. There is a series that I've recorded with the Yaqeen Institute that talks about really defining what is prophetic understanding of holistic wellness and care, and explaining what is mental health from an Islamic point of view. There's historical aspects to that conversation. It's, I believe, a several part series. And then we go into kind of discussions on how do you directly benefit from that kind of practical advice related to this as well.
Oh, that's extremely helpful. So you're keen. Okay, I'll try and link to these in the description below so people can directly access them. Well, I think that's fantastic. Well, thank you very much indeed, Dr. Rania Awad, for your precious time, and absolutely fascinating, actually. And it's a very encouraging message, actually, you're presenting here for Muslims and others as well in exploring a better way to live, I think. Anyway, so thank you very much for your time. Really appreciate it.
Absolutely my pleasure.
Until next time.